Hello, my name is Olivia Harding, and I am the host of Folk Files, a podcast that explores the tangled history of folk songs. Every month, I choose a topic to dive into for about 20 to 30 minutes. The subject of each episode could be a song. In the case of Shady Grove, a lot of people believe that it is a later version of the English folk song Matty Groves, but it's not that simple. A general topic. The main theme that I saw while researching folk songs about birds from all over the world is that many of them include nonsense syllables meant to represent the bird songs. Or a question that I want to answer. There has never been any real question that Black people were central to the development of this musical style. So why do we still picture white men hauling on the rope when we think of sea shanties? Press play and join me on a journey through the origins of murder ballads, sea shanties, rebel songs, and other music that has withstood the test of time. Folk Files is so pleased to be the newest show to join the BGS Podcast Network. Find us at thebluegrasssituation.com or where you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com.
They say there's nothing new under the sun, and ain't that the truth? The Working Songwriter has been on the air for over 10 years and 300 episodes now. As you've probably noticed, only the latest 100 published episodes are available in your podcast app and on Spotify. So, we're bringing back some of the gems from past years. Of course, if you want access to every single episode of the show at any time, you can become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website, joepugmusic.com, where you can access any episode of the show for streaming and for download. In the meantime, we're bringing back some classic episodes to the main feed. Is that a reason to not join The Vault? Of course not, because it means that our latest episodes will only get paywalled all the sooner. Is this a relatively convoluted system? Of course it is. But such are the trade-offs that this ever-changing media landscape leaves us to navigate. Thank you for being here. It's always an honor that you listen to this show, and I hope that you enjoy some of these classic episodes. Today's show with Chris Carraba of Dashboard Confessional was originally aired on June 25th, 2021. I hope that you enjoy this classic episode. Our guest this week is the perfect example of an artist who didn't have a single connection to the music business when he started out, but who rose through the popular culture based solely on the ferocity with which his own fans evangelized his music. In the early 2000s, if you didn't have a friend pass you a Dashboard Confessional album burned to a CDR, I hate to be the one to break this to you, but that means you didn't have very good friends. Chris Carraba began his musical career in Florida in the band Further Seems Forever before striking out on his own with Dashboard Confessional. He became one of the defining artists of emo music, which was once relegated as an offshoot of hardcore, but which is now a genre that is enjoying something of a renaissance in the sounds of chart-topping artists like Drake, Billie Eilish, and even Taylor Swift. In 2002, the video for his song Screaming Infidelities took home the top prize at the MTV Music Awards, beating out a host of more well-connected artists. In 2004, his song Vindicated played over the closing credits of Spider-Man 2, bringing his music to a whole new world of music listeners. His MTV Unplugged album went platinum, his debut record, Swiss Army Romance, and two others have gone gold. He has recorded for Vagrant, Interscope, and Fueled by Ramen Records. He's appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman, Conan, and Jimmy Kimmel Live. Rolling Stone has said that his music speaks to a whole generation of love-bewildered youths. NPR has said that his debut record was The emo of its era distilled to its core purpose, music made to mine and dissect one's own emotions. And none other than the New York Times has anointed him emo's king of pain. I got a chance to speak with Chris a few months ago to hear about his musical journey so far. Chris Carrabba of Dashboard Confessional, what an honor to have you on the Working Songwriter podcast. You spent your formative years in Florida. For many years, I thought the only musical export from Florida tended to be just death metal, but I'm starting to learn that there's a lot of music in Florida, a lot of passionate music. Can you kind of describe what sort of music you grew up around and what were you exposed to musically during those formative years?
Well, before I moved to Florida, I was exposed to a lot of the punk rock and hardcore that I would come to love, but it didn't have the same relationship to where I lived. And it's just kind of surprising considering that part of Connecticut is where some of these legendary hardcore bands are from, you know, Youth of Today, Shelter, those bands, you know. I felt like where I grew up, the thing that people listened to predominantly, and I'd come to appreciate these bands later, were things like The Dead and musicians like Jimi Hendrix and things that I kind of regarded at the time as like our parents' music.
Right.
There's nothing inherently wrong with that, but I myself sort of felt this curiosity about music that it should be discovered for it to be yours. Mm-hmm. So when I moved down to Florida, I had that hunger to find, I really had an attraction to music in, you know, that was just kind of ingrained in me. Through my household, my mother listened to music constantly. You know, I didn't really want to listen to my parents' music, but I did like my mother's choices in music as a fan. You know, she's like, my favorite band of hers that she loved is Fleetwood Mac. But I think the broader truth was that, so she kind of conditioned me to just be a voracious listener of music, but I really wanted to discover it for myself. It was hard back then. Do you remember, Joe? Discover things. You know, if you heard a song that was, you know, not that you wouldn't hear in your normal like top 40 countdown or what have you, how would you possibly know unless somebody told you who that band was? If you just heard it for me, I heard almost all the songs.
I'm sorry.
That's how I found.
You broke up a little bit there. You said for you, how are you finding the stuff?
So almost all the bands I would find at that time when I was newly and most curious about music, I heard in a skate shop, skateboarding shop, you know, because that was my other massive fascination was skateboarding. It was the first thing I was ever good at in my life. And I was really good at it. So, but it was not a thing that was, it was as counterculture as anything has ever been. I think it's become part of the culture, but you kind of had to be brave to do that back then. You were scoffed, beat up, picked on.
Yes.
You know, these kind of, you know, school problems, you know, they kind of amount to nothing. But, you know, it kind of gives you a tribe, a group, an ilk.
Well, and I don't know that it does amount to nothing, because actually what you were doing at that time is you were making a conscious choice to be part of a counterculture, or at least not part of the dominant culture. So even if that does seem like doing it with training wheels in high school, it would be a choice that you'd later carry on later into life.
Well, I was exposed to counterculture that way, but I don't know that it was by choice. I was hungry. I was longing for connection. I was longing for self-expression. So those were the things that I was hanging. I was hanging on by a thread. And when I found that world, that counterculture world, I wanted to explore it fully. So, you know, there was this great overlap between music and the skateboarding and surf culture. Now, once I moved to Florida, I would add surf culture to that. And we would be in these, in the back of the skate shop, maybe on a rainy day when we couldn't skate, and we'd be listening. We'd either be, you know, hearing what would be coming over the radio, the guy who owned it and his kids all had cool music taste. And the guy that managed the shop also had cool music taste, unusual music taste, stuff that I don't think you'd have heard any other way at that time. And also, he would allow us to watch skate videos there. I mean, not in any kind of luxurious way, just like standing in front of the counter where they have the trucks and the wheels and the grip tape and bearings and things. And we would hear these. I remember vividly hearing two bands that really kind of shook me, and just waiting through the. It was the first time I like was found myself like really not so much focused on the skateboarding, just kind of waiting for it to be over so I could see the credits and I could find out who those bands were. Those bands that I said that I'll never forget that really changed my life were Fugazi. And then kind of by extension, Minor Threat, you know, when I went hunting a little deeper for where they had come from as roots, in their roots. And the other band was Operation Ivy. And those two things led tangentially to kind of an odd mashup of bands that I would love forever, like Jawbox on the one hand, through Fugazi, you know, bands like DC bands that you know well from where you live. And then, you know, like things like bands like Green Day. And Lagwagon and bands that I love in that world.
That's a trip. The two styles that you're describing there, on the one hand, the Jawboxes and the Fugazis, are such an attitude, such a percussive assault of music. And then the Green Days and Operation Ivies, there is such an emphasis in melody that I can totally hear that comes through in your music.
Well, I found those two things incredibly appealing. You know, with regard to the almost, you know, like the polyrhythmic, almost like jazz, I guess what I would call like jazz influence, although I would be hard-pressed to know if, or to myself to have any, like, I don't have deep roots as a jazz fan, so I can't tell you that those bands, those like DC Discord bands, maybe they did or didn't listen to jazz, but there is that adventurous rule breaking happening in those songs, and they, like there's almost there's no dogmatic adherence to a time signature or a key, you know, a key center. Well, maybe a key center, but not like, you know, a fixed key. Within any one song, it can go anywhere, and they're very dynamic, very, 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 very dynamic. Now, on the other hand, like Operation Ivy is dynamic, but it's more like all about being brash and never not really having a lot of space. Mm-hmm. Both of those were incredibly appealing to me, and among those bands, on the other hand, like the Green Days and the Lagwagons, certainly Operation Ivy. Melody was king.
Yes.
So what I found for myself was that the marriage of those two things was what I was really on the hunt for. Mm-hmm. As a fan, and I guess think later as a writer.
Yes, I can understand that. I think what's interesting about some of your earlier records when it's... when the acoustic guitar is mixed so prominently, it's like you were trying to put all of those rhythms in there at once with the acoustic guitar, you know?
Well, you know, the evolution of how I came to be in Dashboard was all, the run-up to it was all bands that I was in, of course. It hadn't occurred to me ever that I would do something by myself. But when I did do it, I acutely felt the absence of drums, of bass, of the thing, of any counterpoint for rhythm. And so, and I didn't have like I wouldn't say at that time that I was, you know, I'd come to know what percussion is meant to do with your right hand on acoustic guitar. Mm-hmm. with variations of different finger picking technique and sometimes muting techniques and slapping techniques. And that's not really what I was looking for, though. Now I really love to employ it in a subtle way.
Sure.
But at the time I didn't have those skills, but I had that thinking, you know, this thing's all I've got. So I've also got to imply what the drums might do here.
Right.
And that, I think, was born out of this, you know, when you aren't schooled at all in music, this is my case, the case for me, kind of, when you have no, you know, musical education to speak of, and you're suddenly in a band, and oftentimes those people have had the education in the background of music, well, they can communicate with each other in a way that, you know, this language you don't understand. So you have to find some way to do it. And I remember trying to verbally communicate my drum ideas, or rhythmic ideas, I should say, to the drummer, mm-hmm. and failing really badly for a long time. But as I would do it, I come from an Italian background. I speak with my hands anyway. And I realized I started doing it with my hands. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to do. And I just kind of started to employ that with my picking hand as I discussed it with the drummer or bass player, what have you. So later when I would be writing songs and, you know, not really having a band of my own at that time, I just kind of put that style into the recording or into the playing as I played it.
Let's talk briefly about that very start of Dashboard, because like you said, you were in a few bands beforehand. And then when Dashboard started at the turn of the century, I have a very good friend of mine that saw you play solo acoustic at basically like a youth center in Warsaw, Indiana, like 20 years ago. And when he first told me about that, it really made me realize how grassroots your ascension was with the band. Can you kind of talk about how you got things off the ground? Because it seems like to me, from the outside looking in, it really was you traveling to tertiary markets where people had gotten like a burned CD of yours. That's how I first heard it. Someone passed me a burned CD in high school. You know, how did that get off the ground at the very start?
Well, when I started writing the songs that would be the Dashboard first record, I was still in Further Seems Forever. And we would play these kind of bigger small festivals, but big in the world that we were in. You know, a collection of our favorite bands would be there, and we'd be lucky enough to maybe get an early day slot and stay the weekend. And we would route these tours that would just like essentially amount to gas money. And maybe if we're lucky, gas station food pay. So you make some new friends along the way. You're having this adventure in a bare bones, youthful way. And oftentimes I would just stay in touch with maybe the person that let us stay at their house that night, or the person that actually booked the who knows, the bar, the club, the VFW hall that we played. And when I had Dashboard, well, I guess what happened was I had finished the Swiss Army Romance, and I put it out actually as Further was finishing our full length. I guess we were about to start recording our full length. And the band started to fall apart. Further Seems Forever did. We just started a fraction. Mm-hmm. We remain the best of friends, and now are a band again, even though there's two distinctly different lineups mm-hmm. of the band with two different singers and what have you, which I think is fun. You know, myself, I'm proud to be a member of one of the versions. So and proud of that other version existing and not having to supplant it just because we want to do those songs again too. But I was at the time, I thought before the band started to kind of fall apart, I thought it'd be neat to do this one. Maybe if I could do one tour with this record that I recorded that I had no expectation anybody would really hear mm-hmm. or like necessarily. It just was, thought it'd be an easy, it was my version of doing like a backpacking through Europe. Kind of thing. I thought I'll retrace my steps that I did with the band and maybe there's some kind of journey of self-discovery, because it's kind of, it's a big world, and to go out there just alone is something I thought would be all at once, frightening and rewarding. I was right about that.
Right.
On both counts. But in those, so I think I've illustrated like what I thought the world of music was. I make this joke all the time, but you know, when I got popular enough that people would find out about me with, you know, from more traditional means, like mm-hmm. on the radio or MTV or something, I think they may have assumed that I played like the coffee houses and stuff that you hear about your, you know, standard singer-songwriter
right.
doing. But I didn't do any of that. And it was not by design necessarily. I just genuinely didn't know that that was a thing. I didn't know people went to coffee shops and
right.
sang with an acoustic guitar, because nobody did where I lived anyway. The coffee shop I went to didn't have a singer there.
Right.
They just had coffee. So there wasn't like a culture around. It's like, I'm going to get coffee. That's it. Shows were their own adventurous place. So that's where it began. I just had this network. And it was part and parcel to the culture I was in. So as strange looking as it is to somebody from outside of our scene, I don't think it was that strange to somebody that was in our scene. Maybe it was strange that there was that I didn't have a band, or right. that I sort of had maybe the audacity to just play an acoustic guitar, which I kind of regarded as like pretty punk rock to bucking convention to me is punk rock. So to me that was a pretty punk statement, and those kinds of things were important to me back then. Now I understand it's just the thing I loved the most. Just, you know, I love it as a fan. I really have grown to love that more than any other thing, is when somebody can convey it all by themselves or with very limited instrumentation.
Either solo or with a power trio. That's the money spot right there.
It's the money spot, all right.
Before we move on, though, I just want to dig down a little bit deeper. You mentioned that, you know, going on that first tour by yourself, you know, it's this big expanse of a world out there. Here you are, one guy with a guitar, going out to meet it as a young man, and that it was frightening in some ways. Can you describe what was frightening about it? Can you remember any specific experiences where you were like, holy hell, what did I get myself into here?
Well, there were, I guess, one broad strokes thing is that I never had a plan other than there was a few of these shows, maybe I had a show a week. So one of the hurdles and adventures was that how was I going to get more shows?
Right.
It'd be at one of these shows where I might say, well, I was hoping, not I planned to, but I was hoping to go to Jersey next. Oh yeah. Someone say, well, I have a cousin there, you know, probably put you up. And they have a friend who knows somebody that does shows there. And I would just go.
Yes.
On the advice that there might be someone there that might have a place to play. And then there was the, you know, I had no money. I had no guarantee of money. I had no way to make money. I had no savings. All I had was a van, an acoustic guitar, box of CDs, backpack full of stuff. And so, and a bar of soap and a short length of hose that I would use outside of people's homes, unbeknownst to them, to shower in the middle of the night with. I would go with this, it's 4-foot hose, I guess. And first I'd throw a rock into the backyard, and if no dogs came running or no one barked, I would. Man, it's cold to shower that way sometimes, by the way.
That's insane, man. That's like a story from The Simpsons or something, man.
I wouldn't say it was like a wise thing, and it didn't always work perfectly. I can tell you that.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel? It's funny, you entered the business at a very strange time when it was, we were leaving kind of like the traditional music business to now we're at streaming. In between streaming was that big pirated era. And in some ways, I could understand if you were to feel bummed out that people at the very start were pirating your stuff. But at the same time, it's also like, it's pretty cool that you were able to put out an album like Swiss Army Romance, and people just liked it so much that it just spread because people couldn't help but burn it and give it to their damn friends with your name in Sharpie on it. You know what I mean? Like, it was a really, it seems like a very special time for you to have begun in the business. Do you feel that way?
I was probably the biggest proponent you're ever going to find of Napster, LimeWire, of any that was in a band at that time. But I had no other means of getting a record to someone. Right. I didn't have a P.O. box. You know, if somebody was sent me a, you know, $5, I could have mailed it to him. But other than that, I didn't have a record label that had distribution. I didn't have anybody working on my behalf other than the people that were listening to it. And they were really taking it upon themselves to show someone, to share it with them. And then they were coming to the show.
Right.
They were coming out and they would often buy the CD there. And by the way, they would buy like several a lot of the time. I want to give this to somebody. And I felt that was special because I know what that is as a music fan, to love a band or love something so much, love someone's music so much that you were like, I need this for myself, but I need to make sure my friends feel what this feels like. And so I was really honored by that. And so they would buy a t-shirt, they'd buy a couple of records. I was by no means was I hurt by Napster. I made some money because people's awareness was raised. And moreover, it was a means by which my band began to be known by people that I couldn't wrangle myself and play the music for. If you had the record for me, record at all, if you had one of my records, it's because you bought it from me out of my trunk.
Right.
And I think that's laudable and it was a great experience. But it's not a sustainable thing that gives you a career in the long run. So I had no other means to get it to people. And when I realized that was a way people were getting it to each other, I embraced it wholeheartedly. But mind you, I didn't have a computer at the time. I'd have to go to the library to do my downloading.
Was there is there a specific moment when you can remember thinking to yourself, okay, well, maybe this isn't my version of backpacking Europe to find myself. Maybe this is my career. Like, when did that mental shift happen for you?
Well, I was out with no plan. And then the word started to get around to these places before I got there about my music. And I would show up to play. Now, I wasn't on like a flyer. I wasn't on I didn't have a show till the day before, or maybe that day. So when I realized that I was playing the music and there were kids singing along, they had no lead time. They were just at a show. They went to this place because somebody did shows every Thursday or something like that. So they always were there. And I was just a record they had that they'd embraced. And I remember the surprise they would have. And many times in that era of my band, people would say, how did you learn all his songs? And I would say, no, I'm the dude that did that. And then there would be a moment on for both people in that conversation to just kind of like scratch their head for different reasons.
That was one of the
contributing factors to that moment, that epiphanous moment. The other one was on a few of the shows that I got, there were like three in a row that I had booked beforehand. One was in Virginia. One was in West Virginia. Well, no, actually, pardon me. One was in Norfolk. It was down in Norfolk. And I remember it well. That I was playing with a bunch of hardcore bands. That was kind of my sweet spot. And they said that I was going to be playing last, which is like the death knell, you know?
Right.
That's not like headlining a show. That's playing after most people leave, you know?
Right, right.
So I was a little bit bummed, but also I'd been told I'd have a place to stay, so I wasn't entirely bummed. And plus I got to see some bands play. I remember Hope's Fall was one of the bands. They're a band I really liked. And I felt like, oh, wow, they never come to Florida, so I'll be able to tell my friends I got to see them. And they said stick around, you know, they were kind. They said stick around for Dashboard, whatever. And that's what I thought. That's the reason I thought everybody stayed until I started playing. I mean, because everyone stayed.
Mm-hmm.
Until I started playing, and they just erupted. And that was it. That was a moment. They erupted into the sing-along. Now, I'm from a scene where, like, singing-along is part of the musical fan culture.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like any other probably subsect of, you know, genre of music where you sing along to the hookiest parts, basically.
Right.
But they didn't do that. They just sang every single word. And they did that for the entire set. And that's when I realized, all right, this is a whole different thing. I couldn't then and can't all the way now put my finger on the thing that happened, you know, internally that made me say, all right, of all the things I want to chase, there were a lot. This was the one that was the most, I was most certain of.
When Chris talks about choosing music, he's quick to mention that it was one choice among many. There were many paths that interested him, but he had to make a choice. He had to let some things go. He had to limit himself in some respects so that he could become unlimited in another. And it's important for artists to choose what their losses will be, because losing nothing is not an option. So you'd rather make the decision yourself rather than having it made for you. In that sense, loss always doesn't have to be a negative. And there's a work by the poet Donald Hall that turns that idea of loss upon its head in a similar way. It's entitled Affirmation. To grow old is to lose everything. Aging, everybody knows it. Even when we are young, we glimpse it sometimes and nod our heads when a grandfather dies. Then, we row for years on the midsummer pond, ignorant and content. But a marriage that began without harm scatters into debris on the shore, and a friend from school drops cold on a rocky strand. If a new love carries us past middle age, our wife will die at her strongest and most beautiful. New women come and go. All go. The pretty lover who announces that she is temporary is temporary. The bold woman, middle-aged, against our old age, sinks under an anxiety she cannot withstand. Another friend of decades estranges himself in words that pollute 30 years. Let us stifle under mud at the pond's edge and affirm that it is fitting and delicious to lose everything.
From that point in your career, things really start to take off. You have Screaming Infidelities wins an MTV award when you were up against very, you know, establishment acts like The Roots, The Strokes, and Norah Jones and stuff like that. And then also, one of your songs plays over the credits of a huge blockbuster, one of the Spider-Man movies. It seems to me like at that point, your fan base probably changed dramatically all at once. Was that the case? And if it was that a difficult thing to navigate, going from everyone's best kept secret to being something of more of the headliner that everyone was paying attention to from the start?
Well, there was an evolution of people coming, the numbers of people coming.
Mm-hmm.
There was an increase that was steady. But, you know, I've got to say that the things you just described, the MTV Music Award and the and being having the single for Spider-Man, these things, they would pay off in fan numbers and new kind of maybe kinds of fans, people right. that wouldn't have otherwise listened to my music or maybe otherwise been exposed to my music. But that didn't happen right away. Mm. It wasn't in the time that those things happened. There was just a little bit of a buffer back then that doesn't exist quite exist anymore. At the time that was happening, I think what it felt like was that to me, and I think for anyone that was a fan, was that the fans, this was a victory lap for the fans. Like they had pushed it to so many of their own friends.
Yes.
That it was now like in the door. Like they had manhandled the thing. You know, there was no machinery at work. There was no traditional avenues for success. So everything that happened because for the same reason that Napster was used. Somebody wanted to share it with somebody else. And so this was just sort of the watershed of that moment. I really felt this feeling among my fan base at the time. Now, it wasn't unilateral. Some people didn't care for the fact that we'd gotten popular, and so they moved on to somebody else.
Sure.
But for the most part, it really felt like they felt this was their doing and this was their success. That's how it felt to me. I felt that it was their success. I credited them more than I would any, I don't know, professional whose job it was to see us have success. Those people that I mentioned, they would put in a lot of work later, and right. they would have their own. I would have my own version of success that was theirs. Their, you know, that they were a direct help with. But this that the MTV Unplugged, the VMA, Spider-Man, I lot the success. I would credit that to my fan base, and then to my fan base, including just one or two people that had the job of like picking right. the song. That was important.
What's funny is what you just described. Many of our younger listeners will recognize that model as pretty common nowadays for people to start following someone on social media or following them on Spotify and then helping it become a bigger thing. I don't think what younger listeners might not realize is what you're describing right now, which is common now, that didn't really happen back then. You were almost doing like an analog version of what happens now.
I don't have a good way to describe it to those folks who have only had it that way. I really don't. But it was radical. I mean, it just, there wasn't an infrastructure for such a thing to happen. You know, the closest you'd get was college radio, I think, that would take a chance on a band. And those few outlier radio stations like K-Rock or something like that, you know, they would really kind of champion a band irrespective of a label doing all their work that they do on a band. I didn't have any of those things. All I had was these fans who were telling each other, hey, have you heard this song by Dashboard and suggesting like we should try to go see them if they already come. Then at the time it's just me, go see them if he ever comes around.
And all,
not should no not should
right
We are going to, we will. There was this determination. Yeah, it wasn't passive.
No, I noticed the same thing from the outside looking in. All the while this kind of phenomenon is happening, you are continuing to write, be very creative, release a lot of albums. Can you talk a little bit about what your creative life looked like at that time? And was it any different than what your creative life looks like now? How are you actually writing and producing the music at the very start?
My creative life now reflects what it was in those earliest days, more so than ever in between, more so than any time in between. So the thing was, it was concentrated in the early days. I really released two full lengths and three EPs and wrote the third full length in a period of about three and a half years.
Wow.
And there was an absence of any, I don't know, interference is too strong of a word. Interest from any like machine. Right. You know, there was no label saying, you should do this, we need you to do that. That would come. And that was not an, that was not something I feel I navigated with great success, though I do feel like I learned. And it wasn't like just an object lesson, oh, I shouldn't do that again. I learned a lot from kind of chasing other people's suggestion about maybe how a record should be approached or what kind of songs make for a good career. I did learn a lot and enjoyed that chase, but I did lose the, I lost the path a little bit. I lost my way on the path a little bit. I'm not proud of it, but I'm happy I did do it. I know that's at odds, that statement, but itself. I wish I'd understood more of the power that I'd that I had over my own songs by just having a singular intention.
Mm-hmm.
Later, it just this is what I felt I did right. How's this? At the time, in those early days, what I really did write was I really enjoyed like the granular moments of life. This is what I enjoyed exploring as a writer. You know, that sometimes you life is defined by these huge moments, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems, but it's really like the fine details of those big moments that kind of carve out who you are, and who you are changes. It changes and it changes back and it changes again. It's not stasis by any means, and you never quite succeed at becoming who you're going to be, who you want to be. You just become who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was successful as a writer. And I enjoyed writing about that, the smaller details, and just blowing them up with the importance of the grander thing, but focusing down on the granular details. And then I also feel like I at the time was like very unaware of a lot of the rules of songwriting. And so I broke them out of instinct.
Mm.
So there was a uniqueness to my songs that as I became a better musician, a better player, and more aware of music theory and what have you, more of a deeper understanding of music theory, well, I would come to be able to break those rules kind of with intention when I knew what to do. But in that period where I found out what the rules were, I stayed a little bit too far inside them.
Right.
We had some pop success, but I was never meant to be a pop songwriter, which is really okay.
Right.
Now, there are people that, you know, listen to my songs and they get that. Then there are people that really think I mean, I was on the cover of a lot of magazines and stuff, so I can't blame them for this, but they think I was only ever a pop star.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was barely ever popular, and kind of glad about it.
So you say now that you've kind of returned back to this sort of original mode of creating and creativity. I want to talk about that middle period for a little bit in a moment, but can you speak right now to how you returned back to that original kind of ethos?
Well, I think one of the factors is that I've really deeply fallen back in love with the acoustic guitar as the main I guess, you know, rudder by which I'm going to steer the ship here. Mm-hmm. It's not to say I won't play electric guitar or won't have them on a recording I've done, but when I sit down to write, it's not just like, well, this is a, it's, and I've heard people say this before, it's got to work on an acoustic or it's not really a song. Well, that's all fair and good. But when you're writing with or without you, I don't think that it's supposed to be an acoustic guitar song ever.
Right.
I want my songs to, maybe there's a version of them that, I guess I want my definitive versions to be on acoustic guitar, even if they never get released.
Right.
But I want the most definitive version for me to be with the acoustic guitar. I just find it so, I just find it so powerful. And more so than ever now that it's so easy to dress, which I like as a fan. It's so easy to dress up a recording and amp it up and use it during the writing process. I love that, but to me it is, there's a rawness that limitation brings. But I also find the better I get. You know, here's the interesting thing. So I was in this pretty bad accident this past year.
Yes.
And I lost the ability to play guitar. I lost all muscle memory in my arms. So I had to start taking guitar lessons, which I never had done before. I taken a few, but it was exploratory. I'd already had success as a musician, and I just felt like, oh, yeah, I better do this. But this time I wanted to do it. Well, no, this time I had to.
Had to, right, right.
I had to learn how to play, you know, just like you, anybody who plays an instrument remembers what it's like in the early days when it's hard to bend your fingers a certain way or articulate a position of your wrist or something. So that's what I was dealing with. Only this time I had all the knowledge of what I can do as a musician. And so now I've kind of fallen in love again with the instrument, because as I stand here talking to you today, I'm better than I was before the accident because I've been taking lessons. And but I'm also able to direct where I want the lessons to take me, more so than I would have if I had taken these lessons as a kid.
Right.
And so I'm able to just invest into this instrument, but it's like this disproportionate return on investment. Like I just pour tons. I mean, I honestly still play like 6 hours, 8 hours a day. It's not unusual for me to do that.
Wow.
But what I get out of the guitar is just this wealth of possibility. And I'd love that. I don't think that answers your question about how I've come back to writing.
No, it does. So,
that
had to be terrifying, though, to have lost that muscle memory after your bike accident. I mean, can you kind of speak to the mental space you were in where your hands and arms weren't doing what you were mentally telling them to do? That had to be really terrifying.
You know, it was terrifying. But it was not scarier than the rest of what I was going through, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
So I think in and of itself, if that had been the only repercussion of this motorcycle accident, that would be really very, very scary. But I also had to figure out how to, like, I don't know, brush my own teeth and lift a fork and things like that. So I was less, that seemed like something I could worry about at some point. But what did happen though was that I had this, I was like lovelorn for I was like longing, like you are when you're like a young lovelorn person. Mm-hmm. That's what I was longing for with the guitar. I had that kind of intensity that you kind of lose in adulthood.
Right.
That's what I had gained back. But interestingly, I had written I had actually made a record before the accident that is closer to, that is in the vein of that, how I approach songs when I was a younger person, when I was new to this. So I'd already gotten there, but this has gotten me to a place where I think that I can stay there for longer.
Wow. That's exciting.
It is for me. I never know what my as a rule, I never really know what my fan base would want from me. And I guess as a rule, I've tried not to think about it.
Right.
With the exception being that I was aware then, and I'm aware now, that my career would have been bigger. I would have been more successful if I had delivered another Places You've Come to Fear the Most or Swiss Army Romance sooner. Mm-hmm. But that's a place as a songwriter that you get into, that is hard to, that is easy to get pulled out of, I think. And certainly it's easier to get pulled out of it than it is hard, and it's equally hard to stay there somehow. So it's not really a comfortable place to be.
Right.
It's just a really rewarding place to be. So if you're like faced with some success, I think I looked at it like, well, I'm enjoying these songs that exist now, so I can just like let them be their own thing and chase, you know, other aspects of songwriting. Though I wish I'd stayed uncomfortable. In a sense.
Will you dig in for me just a little bit more about what you mean when you say that's an uncomfortable place to be creatively?
Okay. I think that it's no secret, right, that I write these pretty emotional songs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the butt of a lot of jokes. I get it. And I don't mind it because it's easy to make light of, but it's really, really hard to do.
Right.
It's hard to do because of a few things, and not least among them is, you got to be really, really honest with people you don't know and people you do know, which can be harder, with how you feel about stuff. You have to do it in short form prose, and you have to pack it with all like the emotional wallop that encompasses an entire thing experientially. So, what I mean by that is, you know, say you've lost a loved one or something horrible.
Right.
Or wonderful, equally wonderful. You've fallen in love and it's the right person and you're going to stay with that person. Well, you're investing the totality of that emotional experience into this, I mean, I'm pretty verbose, but there's still very few words in a song, comparatively speaking. And so you're just like supercharging everything and kind of living out on the edge of it. That's very easy to be judgmental of.
Right.
I find it, it's kept me humble to understand that to be good at that is to open yourself up to great criticism.
Right.
That's okay. I mean, I don't love criticism, Joe. I don't love being like, how do I say this? I wish I was like this superiorly enlightened individual that could tell you, I don't need the accolades and the slings and arrows never bother me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I need both of those things. It's great. It's a great fortune to be told, hey, the thing you did is special. That's a wonderful thing. Most people don't have that in their
right.
work world and or in their art world, and to have it in both is incredible. And then to be told or made to feel like you're a joke or the butt of a joke. Actually, it's when you're the joke that's a little harder.
Mm.
That hurts. And so that all comes with the territory, it is, it's easy to withdraw from after a while because you slowly put up these walls of protection from them until
right.
you're so thoroughly behind it that you forget to stand up for the thing in the first place. And so that's what happened to me as a writer. I got more and more vague. I got less and less potent. I had my moments. Thankfully, every record has had its moments.
Right.
Where I got to be the old guy for a bit. And I discovered, I think that I missed that feeling of getting a song right in the way that I personally really like to get songs right, more than I loved, or more so than I enjoyed not being, I guess, stabbed at or picked. What's the right word? I don't know. Picked on? That sounds reductive.
Yeah,
because it's more than that. But it kind of is like it is a bit like that. So, you know, having to admit some things like that to yourself are necessary to getting back to that place. It's like, okay, you know, hey, look, I'm a fallible person. I'm an emotional person. I am. This stuff bothers me because I want to be thought of well. And then also I have to learn to be okay with not being thought of well if I'm going to be embraced to the way I've enjoyed. You know, that's also a wonderful thing.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm not like this victim, and I'm not, and I wasn't, I'm just saying I wasn't spared personally when all the things that were kind of said about me or my band, or even broader, more broadly, my scene that I'm from.
Right.
I was personally affected by these things, and I think the evidence is in the middle era records.
But where you've arrived at now, which is you're kind of describing a full circle return to where you were at the start. But you did mention that you took some positive elements out of that middle period where you were maybe listening to what others were having to input creatively, or maybe you said also that you were just kind of learning more about formally like a music structure, a music theory, where you had just been self-taught before. What do you think you took from that middle period that was positive that you've now added to that original spark?
So there were a lot of things. There were a lot of positive things that I took away from that. But I guess the paramount among them, hold on one second.
Yeah.
My earpieces, you might have to edit that out. I don't know. I think you trouble with that, but I lost my earpieces without talking to you. So I'll start that answer again. So hopefully make it easier for you.
Yeah. All good.
There were lots of lessons to be learned in that period that I'm less connected with. Of my work, that period of my work that I'm less connected with. And the ones that I think were most informative had to do with kind of understanding in a pop song way, the structure, you know, the tried and true structure by which songs should kind of fit into. That stuff never ever occurred to me to think about before that, and it appealed to me less as a fan and a writer, frankly, if I'm quite honest. But to understand that they exist, and to figure out how to be most expressive within those parameters was one of the things that I enjoyed learning from that experience, though I like it less than songs that are just a little weird.
Right. Right. Well, I can't tell you what a thrill this has been for me to have you on the show. It's such a privilege to pick your brain, man. I'm a huge fan. Thank you so much for coming on the Working Songwriter podcast.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it.
This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. Tickets are on sale now for Dashboard Confessional's massive Unplugged Tour, available at store.dashboardconfessional.com. If before we meet again, you sit down to write, please remember,
An expensive drug habit is not a song. A compelling Instagram account is not a song. And most importantly, Reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.